The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the hobo and the pilgrim. And let's begin by finding out what you know about the hobo and the pilgrim. And let's begin with the idea of the theme of journey in modern times, where you've seen that in modern literature, films, books, plays, just in life. Where have you seen anything about man on a journey in our time? Pardon me? All right, Grapes of Wrath, a great, really a great book in its own way. Not exactly the Christian novel, but nonetheless, it's a powerful book. How about a film? Any of you watch films at all? I'm not an RP here. I'm an OP. We can watch films within limits. So, okay. I never look at the ratings myself. I stay away from those that say X and R and that sort of stuff, but I trust all these that I'm going to refer to here will fall in that category. 5 minutes in the lecture and I'm already a liar. Just blame it on being absent-minded. Right? Travels with Charlie, with Steinbeck. Maybe some of his other things, too. We've had one already. I'm thinking of isn't The Pearl a kind of a journey? I think you find several of them are journeys. But certainly Easy Rider, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, isn't it? Right? That here is a kind of a parable of life, and the Easy Rider, very much so. Now, I guess I better not ask you to raise your hands how many have seen it. For a while, I did have the script, and I studied the script very carefully as well as seeing the movie. And it's fascinating. Well, what about The Graduate? I think that's kind of a journey in it, isn't it? It's not maybe as overt and as an Easy Rider, but it's definitely there. It's going through a process of well, there is even physical travel in it, but more than the travel, it's the idea of growing up. Okay, let me ask you this. A few years ago, way back right after the Second World War, now some of you may not be very sharply tuned to that time, so I can see why. There was a movement that came out of San Francisco, the Beatniks. And you remember any of the writers for that? Yes.
Jack Kerouac, On the Road.
Right, On the Road. Jack Kerouac, On the Road. Very much the idea of the journey. Not so far from the Easy Rider in some ways. The spirit of it, at least, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. The whole counterculture movement of the 60s had the journey in it. What was the favorite word? The trip. This is very much so, the trip. Now, this was an inner journey, but it was often interesting that they would have an outer journey tied in with a kind of an inner journey. All right, now this is these are some obvious things. What about a writer that became very popular in the last part of the 60s? Not an American writer, but he's almost been adopted by the Americans. Many of the converts that we saw in the late 60s, early 70s, were addicts on this author. Yeah, Hesse or Hesse. They carried his books around like the Bible. And how many of them can you recall? I think I read almost all of them that were in English. I didn't have enough stomach to read them in German, but after a while I even regretted reading them in English. But how many of them have the trip idea in them? Do you recall? Steppenwolf does, of the sword, you know. Siddhartha, Journey to the East. See, there's this idea of the trip, and of course it's tied in with Eastern mysticism. All right, let's take something else. What about a writer that became very popular in the late 50s, and then the teachers even began to assign it as required reading in the high schools, and I think even got down to junior high school? Salinger, Catcher in the Rye. It's built on a trip, isn't it? It's a journey. Yeah, well, that's in there. I mean, we've really almost stayed away from anybody with a Christian orientation, but you could throw other things in with a Christian orientation. I think T.S. Eliot has something of the same thing in The Cocktail Party. Is certainly a journey, though it really pretty much, I guess, takes place in the living room. But it's a pilgrimage. Very definitely. It's intended to be a Christian play, even before he's Christian, I think. Didn't he write that before he was a professing Christian? I've forgotten. Anyway, Journey of the Magi is a journey, and it's, I believe, his effort to describe his own conversion. Well, there are a lot of things that I can think of in literature. A lot of Faulkner, and sometimes really grotesque Faulkner. I don't know whether any of you have ever earned a Purple Heart by reading As I Lay Dying, but if you have, I'll confer it on you personally. It's really Pilgrim's Progress, run backwards, sort of. There's a lot of that in American literature. Anyway, As I Lay Dying, the character who's telling the story begins by talking about this this whole experience and dies in the process, and they're I don't remember all the details, but they're moving the coffin to the burial place, and it becomes an awful stench. You know, it really is. It's down south and it's hot, and they lose the coffin once in the river. And it's really it's a gross story, but I'm not sure I understand all the significance of it, but it's certainly, you can see the background of Pilgrim's Progress is there. What about, what's the title of it? Is it Rabbit Run or Run Rabbit Run? Rabbit Run by Updike. And definitely wrestles not only with the running of Rabbit, but with the two ministers, Jack Eccles. What's the name of the Lutheran pastor? I forget his name. The Lutheran pastor makes some pretty powerful speech or two concerning the Christian faith. It was quite surprising that would come out that way, that the liberal pastor is really pretty well shot to pieces as a perfect fool, and the one who is the reverent Lutheran, comes out sort of as the hero. You wouldn't expect that. At least I didn't. Well, I think The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath is a kind of a journey. And we could go on. If you go back into the 20s, where the idea of the hobo was... Well, even before that, I don't know, have you ever heard of Vachel Lindsay? Only English teachers and a few other people know about him, huh? Okay. Well, he had an evangelical background, and he went around before the First World War with his proclamation of a balm in Gilead, of the coming of religion of equality and beauty. He was a hobo of sorts, wrote poetry, and you've heard some of the things he's written. General William Booth Enters Heaven, and... things like that. So let's see, what's the one on Abraham Lincoln? These are the kind that get in anthologies. But only English teachers remember them today, I suspect. All right, well, let's talk about now the whole idea of areas of life. And what I want now to zero in on is some of the uniqueness of American culture. Already, you should have got some impression, and so you should be writing in those wonderful notes you're taking in here, impression. And the impression is there's an awful lot of awareness of movement in American life. Awful lot of movement. And if you just consider the amount of physical moving that Americans do, it's really tremendous. I'm not talking about tourism, but I'm talking about the amount of just moving around all the time. Most fluid culture. And so that's a big factor here. And if you think about the movements of peoples in our country in the 20th century, how many mass movements there have been. For instance, the mass movement of blacks out of the South into the cities, especially of the North. It's a mass, one of the greatest mass movements of all time has taken place. But you had with it the movement of the Okies in 1930. Now, when I say that as a Californian. I don't say it in any bad tone, right, Mike? That's the way we describe them, and it's the way they describe themselves. So I think sometimes people said Okieville with a certain sneer, but I think that I don't know any other way to say it. Charlotte, is there any other? And in most of the cities in California, you had sections of town where the Okies came. And some said, had areas where the Arkies came. And some of those got mixed together, but not always. Well, these were great movements of people. And then I think another factor that you notice in our country, which we've already alluded to, is that in the past there have been large number of hobos. Now, if you look at our time, you find that there are other deeper movements, social movements. There are the runaways. We have vast hordes of runaways. It started with the children. Well, no, it really started with the dads, someone has said. They started running away from home with their various jobs, taking them around the world. And then the kids were breaking into it all along, but then the moms decided to go, and now the kids are going too. There's nothing much left to hold them together. There's a kind of a flight, and in this case, it's not necessarily from here to there, but it's from the inside to someplace else, wherever it is, not the home. And back in the late 60s, we noticed that you'd run into young people who were just sort of wandering around, maybe from better class homes, that could not recall ever having had a meal with their parents. With everybody there. Most amazing thing. Now, you first time you heard that, you found that hard to believe. But after you heard it a few times, you began to wonder if there wasn't some truth in it. You realized how the TV set and other things had influenced the shape of American culture and further dislocated it so that it became even more mobile. Well, that still doesn't take us as deep as we might go. A culture also has to be understood by what penetrates it. And I'd like to point out in this idea of the journey, of the unfolding of life as a movement, that in the 20th century, three psychologists, educators, philosopher thinkers, kind of a mixture of both, that have been very influential, John Dewey, Henry James, and Sigmund Freud were all very definitely on the side of movement. Let's take John Dewey's thought for just a second, use that to illustrate it. John Dewey had an idea of freedom. He is so extreme in the idea of freedom that he even wants to attribute some kind of self-conscious freedom to the smallest particles of matter. He's got some statements in his writing that sound completely absurd to me, but it shows you how seriously the idea of movement is concerned. And in his way of thinking, the only thing that he called it growth, And that was the standard. And the only thing that's evil is that which hinders further growth. So the idea, while he stated it somewhat biologically, it has the idea of open-endedness. And the only thing which is evil then is what prevents you from moving. And of course, Henry James had certainly a universe much like that. And Freud, though he didn't talk in these terms of movement so much, was very important because he was instrumental in the destruction of norms and standards which had governed the American home. And so Freud has had an important role to play in the becoming fluid of American society. And many of the revolutionary movements really go back to Freud. And Freud, if you would say this, Darwin became the god of Germany in the 20th century. Darwin really stands behind Hitler in Germany. That in America, the present revolution we're having now is to be placed at the door of Sigmund Freud, even though Sigmund Freud certainly would not endorse all that's being done. He was a firm believer in repression. But his disciples, the neo-Freudians and the rest, have used him as the great, quote, liberator, unquote. And so his teaching was used as a sort of a lever to break down anything that was yet solid in American society. All right, now we could add all kinds of other things, but what I want you to see is that this is really unique to American life. And maybe we can sort of bring this to a climax or a close, whichever you want to call it, by referring to the play that Philmont's going to be putting on, the Wizard of Oz. That's absolutely unique. No other culture in the history of mankind has ever produced a book like that. That's American. At the same time, the Lewis Carroll was writing Alice in Wonderland. Very irrational world, but American world. There's no horse dung on that golden brick road. When the house lights, which Dorothy is in, it lights in the Land of Oz, and it doesn't even make a bloody mess when it hits that witch. She's just sort of a neat little pile of sawdust when they look underneath it to see what happened to the wicked witch, the first one killed. And evil is only apparent. You look at it on the surface, and it looks bad, but if you get behind the wizard, you find he's nothing but a weasened little old man. So you don't have to be afraid. And if you're a lion who's a coward, let's see, all you need to do is know you've got courage. Possibility thinking. And so this is American. It's as American as corned beef and cabbage is Irish. Now, it's the American fantasy. And we're going to have to see how it works out. And, of course, the other thing that I want to say, which ties in with it, is the tremendous conquest of our culture by drugs. That this fits in with it. And you can pick up a little parable of it if you want. I grew up in this culture, believe it or not. Even though I'm older than some of you, I really did, at least I was on the far side of it as it came along. And I was in love with Judy Garland. I was very jealous of Mickey Rooney. I don't know whether you know that, but this may not even mean anything to you. You may not even know who Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney was, okay? But this was way back. This must have been way back in the 30s. Yeah, yeah. Okay, and so I followed Judy Garland very well, and the thing that really horrifies me, if you see the story of her life, here was the facade of life beyond the rainbow. And then you read, years later, how they put that together, how they were really ruining her at that time with drugs. They were giving her drugs to go to sleep on, they were giving her drugs to wake up on as they shot that film. And it was this beautiful world which they were constructing, and that woman was being ruined. And so that when she finally dies, her husband, I forget his name, he can't find her. He knocks on the bathroom door, it's locked. He has to crawl around out the window and into the bathroom. And she's sitting on the toilet, and her face is green already from an overdose of drugs. Now, that's an awful parable, especially even the way they buried her. They buried her with an open Bible on her lap. Because she didn't live by the Bible. And to put it there, you know, seemed to me such a sickening final conclusion of a ruined life. A highly talented, greatly gifted woman, almost a paradigm of the whole culture. And so you see, with that kind of a background, it was just natural for people to switch into other drugs. They saw their parents living on them. Well, we could talk more about this, but I think that if you want to contrast this, European culture has a lot of things wrong with it. And when Europeans sneer at American culture, it makes me a little unhappy, because they often speak of Americans as materialistic. In some ways, we are very materialistic. But in other ways, if you want to meet somebody materialistic, you've got to meet a European. You know, they really are tight. And one place that I get cultural irritation is to see how tight they can be. Not all of them, but I think that they are a little unfair in calling Americans materialists until they see how materialistic some of them are. But having given off one of my pet peeves, and don't let one of my prejudices become yours, love them in spite of it. But the thing is that what they would see about us would be just the things that we have here, the speed with which we do so many things, the busyness, the haste, and the sense of all of us going somewhere, though we may not be exactly sure where we're going. The idea of everybody here being on a trip or moving and so on. I think it's very much part of our way of life. And that we often don't have time to talk. Right. It's very apparent. But my point is that we're so accustomed to it, there's a danger that we won't see what we're all doing. And to sift it, at the very outset, we've got to be aware of to what extent it controls our life. And we shouldn't say it's wrong to move, necessarily. It's just that we ought to be aware that there's no virtue in itself in moving, that you ought to have some kind of purpose in it. Now, for purposes of Christian service, we may need to move. And so I'm not saying we shouldn't. But I think if I can summarize it, the one thing we've got to watch out for is that we don't get ourselves speeded up on the inside in the whole moving process, so that we're never able to slow down, even when our bodies are stopped, that our minds are racing on, that our consciousness is still too rapid. And all of us have caught ourselves in that, haven't you? Haven't you gone home at night and said at some point, now I'm going to relax, and you just didn't relax. It was easier to say than do. Now, of course, you could have that problem whether you were here or in Europe or anyplace else. But let's now look at some of the deeper things about it. Now, we've been talking about the idea of the journey, the movement, and so on in American life. And I'd like to show you that there's something also unique about this in another way. In traditional ways of salvation, usually, here's how people believe in salvation. And this is true to some extent of medieval Christianity. It's also to some, it's certainly true of Buddhism and Eastern thought. But you have the way The road. Now, we're going to talk about the road. You have the first step in the way is the way of discipline, the purgatorio, the purgation, the way of, you could call it chastening. Purgation. Let's make it just... There's enough problems in life without worrying about things like that. But the way of purgation, penance, if you will. And the next step is on the same road, is the way of illumination. And then the what comes after that is the way of union. And I think this pretty well fits most people who are not Christians, and we ourselves get caught up in it, that if they feel if there's a way of salvation, the first step in it is cleaning yourself up by way of suffering. And when this gets worked out in terms of meditation, remember last time we were talking about meditation, then the first step in meditation is to cleanse yourself of all negative thoughts. In fact, cleanse yourself of all thoughts, period, if you get this going far enough. Zen Buddhism, the koan, the reason they talk about one hand clapping, or the disciple gets kicked by his master, or whatever may happen. It sounds all chaotic. That's the purpose of it. The idea is that you're trying to break down manners, logic, customs, whatever it may be, so that you can have a new inflow. It's a kind of romanticism, is really what you have in Zen Buddhism. I doubt if the interpretations I've heard of it from Franz Schaefer, almost making it a form of Western nihilism, are quite right. I think it's much more of a form of Eastern Chinese romanticism, in which the idea is if you knock down enough, you clear around enough empty things, or get it empty enough, then something great and good will flow through. And that's really what this is pretty much the way of salvation of most cults. Greek religion, this is definitely it. So you suffer, you wear a hair shirt, whatever your thing is, in getting yourself what you think will reconcile you to God. And then you have illumination. Maybe you don't eat for 3 weeks. And then you begin to see lights. No, you will after 3 weeks. It sounds funny, but if you go long enough without eating, you will see lights or something equivalent. And then you feel the presence of something, and that leads you to a state where you feel one with everything. And this is a negative way. It's eliminating all consciousness of that which is in front of you. The Buddhists speak of it as samsara. You get rid of the awareness of the things in front of you, the things that give you anxiety, and you enter now into this world where you get enlightenment. Yeah, that's the Buddhist word. Sure, fits in with Buddhism perfectly. You get enlightenment. And out of this, you get a union with the infinite. The Buddhist way is with really almost with the zero, and the Hindu with the one. But whatever way you do it, I want you to see one overriding consideration, that salvation comes at the end of the road, not at the beginning. And so the idea of the pilgrimage has traditionally taken this form. Except in the Christian faith, where you begin with union with Christ, the system has always been worked out one way or another like this. And of course, even in our own hearts, there's a constant struggle with our temptation to reverse it, go back to the other. Now, if you see that, you begin to see that this whole American secularized idea of the journey tends to run counter to this, at least on the surface. Now, we're going to see whether it really does, but it claims to run counter to it. The typical American businessman, if he were in any reasonable shape at all, in the Ben Franklin tradition, into the jungle at 17 and out a millionaire at 21, right? I'm quoting Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman. But you wouldn't think of wearing a hair shirt. Life's too good. Only screwballs would do that. So what I'm trying to say is there's something special in America. A special kind of lunacy, which is almost like faith. And so all of these books you've been seeing, you'll find them tinged with some kind of hope that salvation can come at the beginning. It's kind of a perversion of the biblical view of salvation. And the whole point, now in other words, let me go back. I'm a firm believer in repeating myself so I can understand what I'm saying. Let me come back to that once more, just to make sure everybody's aboard. And I'll put it in different words. That ordinarily, the sinner outside of Christ, when he thinks of drawing near to God, thinks of what he should do. How to work so that at the end of a road of work, he can find salvation. That is deep, it's instinctive, it's automatic. But when you get to the United States, it would almost seem as though the law of original evasion had been repealed. Because the American knows there's hope and you can have salvation at the outset. Well, now we've got this out there, and I called it a form of lunacy, but it's close enough to faith that sometimes you can't tell the difference. It's simply that what you have in America is that there has been so much gospelizing that there's no country in the world where free grace has so many parodies. Are you with me? That America has been so filled with the gospel from the beginning that even our myths, which may be radically secular, are kind of strange echoes of the gospel. And so you have that queerest lunatic myth of all, the Wizard of Oz, which would tell you that you're already in a saved state when you get on the road. Everything's all right. You don't have to be purged of anything. Or if you have to be purged of anything, it's the idea that you need to be purged of anything. The power of positive thinking is American's gift to the human race. Now, you may not think that's the greatest gift, but here it is. And that's why some people think we're the most dangerous people in the world. Graham Greene has written a number of his, at least I think of a couple of novels built around the fact, never trust an American. The idea being that an American is a dangerous child who does not understand the evil of evil. So that's an interesting point of view. So now what we need to see then is that in the United States, the idea of the journey is influenced by a kind of a Christianized romanticism. Now, it would be unfair to say there's never been any of this in Western Europe. There has been. But it's especially here that it's come into its flower. And this is one of the biggest problems that the preacher has to cope with in preaching, because people tend to put his thoughts on the grid of the Christianized romanticism. And we can give you some illustrations of that later. But let's talk now about the characteristics of, say, the American hobo and his journey. We call him the American pilgrim, if you will, the secularized pilgrim. And first of all, there is the belief in the road itself. That the road itself, if you can get on it, means you lose your burden. Now, this is what we've just been saying. I'm just spelling it out now in terms of the metaphor of the journey. That if you can get on the road, if you can find that right road, you lose your burden. And so they're really saying salvation is at the beginning. At least you get the into the state of it, though you may not have the perfection. And so that's a most unique thing. That there's a kind of a sentimental brotherhood in which if you find the right route, if you get the right song and the right open road, it'll all turn around for you. That the evil lies. Now, here's where the romanticism comes in, and you see its radically different character from Scripture, in that evil is in the institutions. Evil is in the laws. Evil is in corporate structures. It's in big, bad unions. And so on. Whatever it may be, you know, each guy sees it in various things. It's in logic, libraries, seminaries, if you will. Wherever you want to find it, you'll find it. But to be out there in the open road, which may be any number of things, that is where you lose your burden. And some people have taken that simply as travel. Just simply physical travel. The beachcomber. When the beach gets dirty, he moves down the beach. The problem today is that you're meeting 10 beachcombers coming the other way who dirtied the beach beyond you. So we have an ecological crisis. But this was the theory. And so you, whether it was drugs, whether it was alcohol, whether it was that California out there, that passage to India, wherever it was, if you got on it, you'd be all right. And what you've got then, you've got a belt of American hippies all the way from Amsterdam to Kabul, Afghanistan. I was most astonished, a few of my own travels, to find American long hairs, you know, almost everywhere. And Kepa Simpangi was telling me, who do you suppose were the first to be expelled from Uganda by General Amin? And I thought it was the Israelis, the missionaries, the Israelis, etc. No, no, the first were the American longhairs. They were all over Uganda. It was amazing. And the idea, I think, here is where they very self-consciously have the view, if you get the right road, which it may be a commune for some of them, and the easy rider, notice, they blew it because they didn't stay at that farm. They were on the right road, but they went right on past the destination to New Orleans, and that's why they lost their lives. Now you see, there's the attitude. But now earlier, you see, this has been deep in American culture. Earlier, the right road was education. If we can build enough schools, we can change the world. Horace Mann. Or for a while, it was the League of Nations, then the United Nations. For a time, it was science. Or bringing them all together in the public school. And so this was the characteristic that there was a sort of an absolute faith in the road. If you could get on that road, you could make it. And that's why you keep having in America, I wonder sometimes whether Europeans do think we're odd, because we're always coming up with new little fads. And I didn't bring the book with me, but there's a book, you know, on assertion, asserting yourself. That's the latest cure-all. If you can't do anything else, assert yourself. You know, and there's a lot of things in it that are true enough. You know, and Norman Vincent Peale, not everything he said was wrong. And so there may be some major truth in these things. But the point of it is, each one of them somehow comes across to Americans as the road. And they accept them as salvation. Now, the thing is that basically, as ways of salvation, this may vary, but they tend to be social or psychological or a combination thereof, or physical. And they could all be all three. And they presuppose that man's basic problem isn't too bad. Now, it's interesting where people have pursued this in a serious way. Sometimes the goal comes out fairly clear. And that goal is usually unity with an implicit healing in it. Let me give you someone who is as a thinker with some depth is John Dewey. I mean, I don't think John Dewey was a complete fool. He said some very foolish things. But in his book, A Common Faith, he says it's really true that you can't get along without some kind of unity, of a deep kind of unity in life. Now, he offers that as humanistic religion, and almost unity is an end in itself. But he sensed that. And so many of these people are looking for some kind of experiential unity, maybe on one level of a brotherhood, a democratic brotherhood. This is Walt Whitman. Song of the Open Road, Passage to India, all the rest. Even death itself is a unifier for Whitman. So there's this unifier and the healing power of a common experience. And it fits in with the idea of a more radical democracy. And so the healing may be thought to come through the trip to India. Eugene O'Neill, maybe there's South Pacific out there, what do they call them? The Magic Isles? I've forgotten what he calls them, something like that. It may be California for many, the commune, or it may be nature. It may be that nature which will save you, or even death. Whitman is a kind of a worship of death as the great unifier. Out of the cradle, endlessly rocking, when lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed. And so the idea is then that you can, through going down this road, get it together, maybe even with the infinite. So that's the goal. The presupposition of all of this, this journey, which is the third point I want to make, we've talked about the means, which is the road, we've talked about the goal, is a kind of a mystical unity. And the presupposition of it, and this is where our trouble comes in terms of the practical cutting edge, it is that everyone has a right to be happy or enjoy himself. That's really what the road is about. Happiness is your basic right. Now, that's almost a guaranteed formula for supplying a whole nation with built-in unhappiness. Anyone who thinks happiness is his basic right, stand back. You got a spoiled brat. Now, of course, I know the framers of the Declaration of Independence, they only spoke of the pursuit. Isn't that how they put it? The pursuit of the right to happiness, or something like that. Or the pursuit of happiness, which did they say? Pursuit of happiness. I can't buy that. you have no right to pursue happiness. I think that's the best way in the world to make yourself unhappy. We'll talk about that just a little bit later. But anyway, it's that kind of presupposition that makes people bitter. And it's why that our culture, being the most affluent one, begins to break down as each man gets on his road, because people think they're entitled to this kind of right. And it's this right to happiness, you see, that explains all the liberation movements, or at least a great deal. I'm not saying there's... And I don't want to come across here as a hopeless conservative attacking everything that's good that's happened in the world for 200 years. I don't mean to sound that way, and I don't believe that. And I think out of most things that we mess up, usually a good thing or two comes out of it. And, you know, I must confess, I learned a lot of good things from the counterculture, even though I can't endorse it. And so what I'm saying then is that once you get this poison, this bitterness of feeling happiness as your right or pleasure, then you need to be liberated as you go down the road. And you'll find that it never works. That instead of getting salvation, as you progress, that you run into circumstances which will force you to a crisis. I never forget that one example. I don't know whether I used this in class in here last week or not. Sometimes I use the same examples twice. That's all right. You have to bear with me. It's a sign of age. So I'll try not to do it too many times. But did I tell you about the lady that Mrs. Clowney met a few years ago in the supermarket? Oh, I'm relieved. Because I think this is a powerful illustration of someone on a trip that broke down. She was quite aged, I would suspect in her 80s, and she had here she was in the line for at the supermarket, and Mrs. Clowney befriended her. I don't know exactly under what circumstances, but she said to Mrs. Clowney that she had some problems and sort of began to break down in front of her. Quite elderly. And Mrs. Clowney, being just, you know, really wonderfully open-hearted person, took her in tow and called the Millers. And so we and some students went over to visit her on a regular basis. And here's turned out the story. She'd been Christian Scientist for years and years, and it always had worked. Now, the basic thing in her trip was very American. Banish every evil thought from your mind. Everything negative, clear it out. I'll never think anything negative about anyone. You know, that's not so bad. But here she was. Her son had had a heart attack, and her daughter-in-law, who had disliked her for years, now revealed clear evil and refused to let the mother see the son. And there's a great deal of wickedness being manifested by the daughter-in-law. And what was tearing this aged woman to pieces was that her whole religion had failed. She was thinking bitter thoughts and could not help it. And she was in agony. And you just can't imagine what a privilege it was to bring the gospel to that dear lady and to bring her into the real journey. It's a real privilege. I can remember the student that went with me, and this is probably the first person he'd ever witnessed who, since he, quote, became reformed. And his last question to me was, now, how do I say it? I said, well, don't worry all that much about it, but here's the way I say it. So he got it just exactly backwards. It was as arbitrary as anything you could have hunted for. I about fell off my chair. I was laughing inside. You know, he tried so hard to be reformed. You want to really want to get that cross and impress his professor. But anyway, in spite of the two of us, the lady began to get the idea. And it really was a beautiful time just to, at this crisis point in her life where God wouldn't let her go, where God's revelation in history and experience broke in. And so that's really what happens. Because the next thing I want to say is that in the trip, usually there's a healer. On that road, there's a healer of some kind that they trust in. And what had happened to this lady is the healer had failed. The healer had been a particular way of doing things under the guidance of the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy. Now, that healer might have been any number of things. It could have been all the way from medical science to a religious leader. Today it might be a guru of some kind. Whatever it would be, at some point, you see, the healer can't heal even himself. And everybody can see it. And all you need to do is just sit around a little while and wait, and this is going to happen. The healer will always be exposed. Now, this desire, maybe even for the man to be his own healer, is very strong. See, who wrote, I forget his name. The behaviorist who wrote Walden 2 and beyond. Skinner. You know, he presents, of all the arrogance, you know, in Walden 2, at one point, he stretches himself out in the grass and forms himself like this as though he's Christ. First time I read that book, I thought this guy's joking. But then it dawned on me that he wasn't. He was offering himself as the healer. Now you get the same thing in Catcher in the Rye. What does he want to do for all the little children of the world? He wants to protect them, get the edge of the cliff, and he'll catch them all. But you see, the point of the whole book is he can't even heal himself. And so you see, it's the men are working against the universe. And what they really do then, and this is the last point I want to make on this, is their whole idea is still salvation by escape. The heater will not work, and it exposes that really their whole road is a road away from God and not towards Him. And if you look at the scripture, here's where Adam and Eve come into the picture. They are introduced to us, once they have sinned, as the great evaders, and they're on a journey. And that journey consists in, at the outset, in hiding from God, and yet having a longing for the things which God has. And that's the tension. This is tragedy. Man made for paradise, for fellowship with God, falls so far short of it, and the distance between what he was made to be, and sometimes senses he was made to be, and what he is in reality is tragedy, right? Sure, that's right. Yeah, I can hear somebody over there saying amen. Right? No, I think that's worth considering. The tragedy is that difference between what we were appointed by God to be in our original state and what we are, and what the sense we have of not being what we should be. And I tell you, you can get on the road and you can do all the things you want to make that road joyous and so on. If you don't deal with that problem of how to get back into paradise, you're going to be terribly frustrated. And so when you open chapter 4 of Genesis, you find here is Cain in flight. Rejection of his brother, murder of his brother, rejection of God even before that, then building a city. And notice that one of the first ways of fleeing from God is building a city. Notice that? Sure it is. He builds a city. The Tower of Babel, build a city. And so that part of that evasion is trying to reconstruct paradise whether we use the metaphor of the city or the road, it's still a way of evading God. Now, what is behind it all? And it's finally this, and this brings us to the book of Hebrews. And it is that, just let me survey now what we've covered. We've seen the picture of the U.S. as a place with a great deal of movement. Uneasy people. Now, some people moving because they need to move. Good and fine. But there's a great deal of movement, internalized and all the rest. And a lot of it is just pointless around and around. A lot of people are using it, though, as a way of salvation. And if they believe that some romantic experience on the road or something else will give them freedom, and they can be healed and find unity. Now, I said that they always come to a crisis, and at some point there they find that it doesn't work. They may lapse back into something else, but it doesn't continue. And the reason that this is so is that there's something wrong with them and their relationship with God. And what I want to say is the word is conscience or consciousness. In the man, you see, was made by the Holy One. And now, because he is unholy, he finds God strange and alien. And he feels hostile. Woe is me, for I'm a man of unclean lips. I'm ruined. Mine eyes have seen the King. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. His name is holy, Kadosh, 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 Yahweh Tzavaot. The whole earth is full of his glory, and I can't endure it. I must run. I must die, literally. Woe is me, I'm ruined. I have pronounced upon me the malediction of the prophets, the oath. I must say of myself when I see the whole truth about God and me together, I must die. There can be no road of escape. And that knowledge I never can lose. And the road of penance will never help me. And the only answer then to that conscience, deeply troubled by the knowledge that this universe is ruled by the Holy One, and that I myself am the product of his hands, the only answer to that can be found in the book of Hebrews. And it is that the angels themselves are staggered by the revelation of what God has done in Jesus Christ. That God has introduced into history the true pilgrim. That we've got a line going. Look with me at Hebrews chapter 12. I asked you to read this for tonight. I'll bother your conscience a bit if you did or didn't, but I want you to be reading it. You'll notice here in chapter 12, we are introduced to the whole race, the whole pilgrimage, and then we read in verse 2, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him. And there's a question there of the preposition, what it means, whether it's set before him or instead of the joy set before him. Endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, the point of that word there for fix, let us fix, or gaze, seems to be something like this. That you're looking at something which leaves your eyes completely surprised, all agoggle, if you will, agog, astonished. It's not the intellectual gaze, in one of the other words, or even an ordinary just plain looking. It's rather being looked at something that leaves you stunned. And then there's a second thought, I believe, a second sense can tied up in the second idea. And it's also that which is so astonishing, it must capture you. You look and you are arrested. You are gripped. You gaze and you see. And what do you see? And now we come into what enables us to face the Holy One and to live this life of faith. He tells us back in chapter 11 about the whole line. And you know, it gets a little bit depressing because here you don't meet Holden Caulfield. You don't meet Jack Kerouac. And you don't meet John Steinbeck or anybody else. But you meet the world's most impressive faith people. Incredibly strong. Who do things you and I would tremble even to think about. And you say, well, this is a nice chapter. Every chapter, everybody ought to have some heroes on his walls, and we'll leave these on the walls and go ahead and read something else. But that's not the point of the whole passage. You're being given this line of faith pilgrims for a purpose. And this means that you've got to understand what this faith is and what it's tied into. Now, let me use an illustration. I visited Niagara Falls recently. My daughter got me there. It was a long, long drive. I think it was worth it, though. And as we were looking there, the thought occurred to me that here were these power plants on the American side and the Canadian side. And you think of all the cities that must be lit from the power that comes from those plants. Now, maybe my imagination is misleading me, but I suspect that somewhere inside there's a very small switch that could send all that power to those cities. And that I might even pull it down with my hands without any trouble. Or maybe even with my left hand. Or maybe even with my left finger. You know, sometimes switches aren't big at all. You know, you turn those lights on, it doesn't take too much power. Even I can do it without much sweat. And yet when I take that finger or that hand and I pull that switch, power, which didn't have too much to do with the finger, comes and lights up all those cities and runs all those factories. And that's really what he's saying faith is. In itself, it isn't really very much. And so that's why he says here in verse 11, it accomplishes so much, because it's a pulling of a switch of the power of God. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. In other words, faith here is pictured as that which puts you in contact with a holy God through the merits of Jesus Christ. And that's the whole point of chapter 10. The whole movement of the book is that God has made an open road into the holiest of all through Jesus. And the whole point of conscience is taken care of in chapter 10. It says, let us draw near with a true heart and the full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Hallelujah! The door is open! The road is here! Jesus is the road! Now, my faith, it's only a little finger. But it holds Jesus. And therefore, these fellas better watch out. Because they're not the head of the line even. Jesus is. And therefore, I don't have to sit and worry whether I'm ever going to be able to build an ark
for 120 years like Noah, or come with the righteousness of Abel, or the faith and the fervor of the fellowship of Enoch, or that I will be able to walk out the way Abraham did and offer his son on Mount Moriah. Finally, it's easy. Kierkegaard misunderstood it completely. Fear and trembling, he's a nut. I seem to be after nuts tonight. Well, he's one of them. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't a Christian. I don't know what his personal faith was. But he depicts Abraham going up that mountain, scared to death, fear and trembling. Why, Abraham's all the various ways that you get scared, he has him. There's not a thing of that in the Bible or this passage. The point of the passage is that when you believe in the living God through Jesus Christ, that the very life and power of the Spirit of God is working in you, and things that you could never do by yourself, you now see done. You might put it like this. The whole heart of the Reformation, then, is that we may be a spiritual pilgrim in every sphere of life, because we who were trying to climb this mountain road, and it didn't work, we kept falling back, God the Spirit came along and He took us, and by eagle wings He enabled us with one swoop to fly to the top. And so what these people were making a parody of, I now have. That my conscience through the blood of Jesus is cleansed from dead works to serve the living God. And the whole point of Hebrews is that God has spoken one final word. And that word is Jesus and His work. And that's the point now, back to chapter 12, that he says why you should fix your eyes on Jesus. Do you wonder whether your faith is weak or strong? Stop wondering. That's the wrong way to strengthen faith. You tend to look inside. What will you see? More of the same. But he says, look away from yourself and fix your eyes on Jesus. Be astonished. And then he says he'll be the first in the line, the file leader, the pioneer, and perhaps perfecter, but also perhaps vindicator. He'll be the one who lifts you through. He'll be the power on the road. Now you see then, this becomes the driving thing in the Christian pilgrim. Now, I don't know whether that makes sense to anybody else, but it sounds pretty good to me. Running it through just once more, from another point of view slightly, or one that we've used before. Here were Adam and Eve cast out of the garden. There were the flaming sword of the cherubim to prevent them from having life. Those swords said to their consciences that you sinner, you shall die. But now, in Jesus, that sword was plunged into his side. And he took the penalty, and from that side came cleansing and life and the opening of fellowship with the living God, so that the way back into the holiest of all is opened. And so Jesus is in heaven, and that heavenly ministry is right here in my life and yours by faith. And therefore, I can be a pilgrim. I can be in the 20th century. I'll suffer like everybody else in the 20th century. I may die. But whatever I do, wherever I am a pilgrim. And that enables me to do certain things the others wanted to do. It enables me to lose burdens. Not only the burdens of sins as we ordinarily think of them, but the sins that often middle-class people don't see. The burden of living for material things. Having the heart and the life ruined because you're tied up with temporal values. That's deadly. The whole idea of a pilgrim is he's got a light load, right? And that's what they're after. Walden Pond, why did he go out there? The chapter on economy in Walden by Thoreau. Why did I go out here? To see how poor I could be? No. To see how little I needed so I could be free to do what I wanted. So the Christian then can be ruthless in terms of material things. He can use them or he can not use them. They're not his God. The same thing can be true of other parts of life. Once he's a pilgrim, he begins to realize that every experience that's got bitterness in it is a cross appointed by God. And what a liberation once he accepts that he's on a holy road and he's a holy man. And everything that comes his way, he may embrace as a cross for his growth in love and peace and joy.